I've never seen it, Shallan wrote. Why? Luesh wore a pendant with this symbol on it, Nan Balat sent. We found it on his body, and one of the men who came searching for the soul caster had the same pattern tattooed on his hand, just below his thumb. Curious, Shallan wrote. So, Luesh? Yes, Nan Balat sent. Despite what he said, I think he must have been the one who brought the soul caster to father. Luesh was involved in this, perhaps as liaison between father and the men backing him. I tried to suggest that they could back me instead, but the men just laughed. They did not stay long or give a specific time by which the soul caster must be returned. I doubt they'd be satisfied to receive a broken one. Shallan pursed her lips. Balat, have you thought that we might be risking a war? If it becomes known that we've stolen an Alethi soul caster... No, there wouldn't be a war, Nan Balat wrote back. King Hanavanar would just turn us over to the Alethi. They'd execute us for the theft. Wonderfully comforting, Balat, she wrote. Thank you so much. You're welcome. We're going to have to hope that Yasna doesn't realize that you took the soul caster. It seems likely she'll assume that hers broke for some reason. Shallan sighed. Perhaps, she wrote. Take care, Nan Balat sent her. You too. And that was it. She set the span read aside, then read over the entire conversation, memorizing it. Then she crumpled up the sheets and walked into the sitting room of Yasna's quarters. She wasn't there. Yasna rarely broke from her studies, so Shallan burned the conversation in the hearth. She stood for a long moment, watching the fire. She was worried. Nan Balat was capable, but they all bore scars from the lives they'd led. Aelita was the only scribe they could trust, and she... Well, she was incredibly nice, but not very clever. With a sigh, Shallan left the room to return to her studies. Not only would they help get her mind off her troubles, but Yasna would grow testy if she dallied too long. 5 hours later, Shallan wondered why it was she'd been so eager. She did enjoy her chances at scholarship, but recently Yasna had sent her to study the history of the Alethi monarchy. It wasn't the most interesting subject around. Her boredom was compounded by her being forced to read a number of books that expressed opinions she found ridiculous. She sat in Yasna's alcove at the Vale. The enormous wall of lights, alcoves, and mysterious researchers no longer awed her. The place was becoming comfortable and familiar. She was alone at the moment. Shallan rubbed her eyes with her free hand, then slid her book closed. She muttered. I'm really coming to hate the Alethi monarchy. Is that so? A calm voice said from behind. Yasna walked past, wearing a sleek violet dress, followed by a parchman porter with a stack of books. I'll try not to take it personally. Shallan winced, then blushed furiously. I didn't mean individually, Brightness Yasna. I meant categorically. Yasna lithely took her seat in the alcove. She raised an eyebrow at Shallan, then gestured for the parchman to set down his burden. Shallan still found Yasna an enigma. At times she seemed a stern scholar, annoyed by Shallan's interruptions. At other times there seemed to be a hint of wry humor hiding behind the stern facade. Either way, Shallan was finding that she felt remarkably comfortable around the woman. Yasna encouraged her to speak her mind, something Shallan had taken to gladly. I assume from your outburst that this topic is wearing on you, Yasna said, sorting through her volumes as the parchmen withdrew. You expressed interest in being a scholar. Well, you must learn that this is scholarship. Reading argument after argument from people who refuse to see any other point of view? They're confident. I'm not an expert on confidence, Brightness, Shallan said, holding up a book and inspecting it critically. But I'd like to think that I could recognize it if it were before me. I don't think that's the right word for books like this one from Madaria. They feel more arrogant than confident to me. She sighed, setting the book aside. To be honest, arrogant doesn't feel like quite the right word. It's not specific enough.
And what would be the right word, then?
I don't know. Arrogant, perhaps.
Yasna raised a skeptical eyebrow.
It means to be twice as certain as someone who is merely arrogant, Shallan said, while possessing only one-tenth the requisite facts. Her words drew a hint of a smile from Yasna.
What you are reacting against is known as the assuredness movement, Shallan. This arrogance is a literary device. The scholars are intentionally overstating their case.
The assuredness movement? Shallan asked, holding up one of her books. I guess I could get behind that.
Oh?
Yes. Much easier to stab it in the back from that position.
That got only an eyebrow raise. So, more seriously, Shallan continued.
I suppose I can understand the device, Brightness. But these books you've given me on King Gavilar's death are more and more irrational in defending their points. What began as a rhetorical conceit seems to have descended into name-calling and squabbling.
They're trying to provoke discussion.
Would you rather that the scholars hide from the truth like so many? You would have men prefer ignorance?
When reading these books, scholarship and ignorance feel much alike to me, Shallan said.
Ignorance may reside in a man hiding from intelligence, but scholarship can seem ignorance hidden behind intelligence.
And what of intelligence without ignorance? Finding truth while not dismissing the possibility of being wrong?
A mythological treasure, Brightness, much like the Dawn Shards or the Honor Blades, certainly worth seeking, but only with great caution.
Caution? Yasna said, frowning.
It would make you famous, but actually finding it would destroy us all. Proof that one can be both intelligent and accept the intelligence of those who disagree with you? Why, I should think it would undermine the scholarly world in its entirety.
Yasna sniffed. You go too far, child. If you took half the energy you devote to being witty and channeled it into your work, I dare say you could be one of the greatest scholars of our age.
I'm sorry, Brightness, Shallan said. Well, I'm confused. Considering the gaps in my education, I assumed you would have me studying things deeper in the past than a few years ago.
Yasna opened one of her books. I have found that youths like you have a relative lack of appreciation for the distant past. Therefore, I selected an area of study that is both more recent and sensational, to ease you into true scholarship. Is the murder of a king not of interest to you?
Yes, Brightness, Shallan said. We children love things that are shiny and loud.
You have quite the mouth on you at times.
At times? You mean it's not there at others? I'll have to...
Shallan trailed off, then bit her lip, realizing she'd gone too far.
Sorry.
Never apologize for being clever, Shallan. It sets a bad precedent. However, one must apply one's wit with care. You often seem to say the first passably clever thing that enters your mind.
I know, Shallan said. It's long been a foible of mine, Brightness. One my nurses and tutors tried very hard to discourage.
Likely through strict punishments.
Yes. Making me sit in the corner holding books over my head was the preferred method.
Which, in turn, Yasna said with a sigh, only trained you to make your quips more quickly, for you knew you had to get them out before you could reconsider and suppress them.
Shallan cocked her head.
The punishments were incompetent, Yasna said. Used upon one such as yourself, they were actually encouragement, a game. How much would you have to say to earn a punishment? Could you say something so clever that your tutors missed the joke? Sitting in the corner just gave you more time to compose retorts. but it's unseemly for a young woman to speak as I so often do. The only unseemly thing is to not channel your intelligence usefully. Consider. You've trained yourself to do something very similar to what annoys you in the scholars. Cleverness without thought behind it. Intelligence, one might say, without a foundation of proper consideration. Yasna turned a page. Arrogant, wouldn't you say? Shallan blushed. I prefer my wards to be clever, Yasna said. It gives me more to work with. I should bring you to court with me. I suspect that wit, at least, would find you amusing, if only because your apparent natural timidity and your clever tongue make such an intriguing combination. Yes, Brightness? Please, just remember that a woman's mind is her most precious weapon. It must not be employed clumsily or prematurely. Much like the aforementioned knife to the back, a clever jibe is most effective when it is unanticipated. I'm sorry, Brightness. It wasn't an admonition, Yasna said, turning a page. Simply an observation. I make them on occasion. Those books are musty. The sky is blue today. My ward is a smart-lipped reprobate. Shallan smiled. Now, tell me what you've discovered.
Shallan grimaced. Not much, Brightness. Or should I say too much? Each writer has her own theories on why the Parshendi killed your father. Some claim he must have insulted them at the feast that night. Others say that the entire treaty was a ruse, intended to get the Parshendi close to him. But that makes little sense, as they had much better opportunities earlier.
And the assassin in white? Yasna asked.
A true anomaly, Shallan said. The undertexts are filled with commentary about him. Why would the Parshendi hire an outside assassin? Did they fear they could not accomplish the job themselves? Or perhaps they didn't hire him, and were framed? Many think that is unlikely, considering that the Parshendi took credit for the murder.
And your thoughts?
I feel inadequate to draw conclusions, Brightness.
What is the point of research, if not to draw conclusions?
My tutors told me that supposition was only for the very experienced, Shallan explained.
Yasna sniffed. Your tutors were idiots. Youthful immaturity is one of the Cosmere's great catalysts for change, Shallan. Do you realize that the Sunmaker was only 17 when he began his conquest? Gavara hadn't reached her 20th weeping when she proposed the theory of the three realms.
But for every Sunmaker or Gavara, are there not 100 Gregors?
He had been a youthful king, notorious for beginning a pointless war with kingdoms that had been his father's allies. There was only one Gregor, Yasna said with a grimace. Thankfully. Your point is a valid one. Hence the purpose of education. To be young is about action. To be a scholar is about informed action.
Or about sitting in an alcove reading about a 5-year-old murder.
I would not have you studying this if there were no point to it, Yasna said, opening up another of her own books. Too many scholars think of research as purely a cerebral pursuit. If we do nothing with the knowledge we gain, then we have wasted our study. Books can store information better than we can. What we do that books cannot is interpret. So if one is not going to draw conclusions, then one might as well just leave the information in the texts. Shallan sat back, thoughtful. Presented that way, it somehow made her want to dig back into the studies. What was it that Yasna wanted her to do with the information? Once again, she felt a stab of guilt. Yasna was taking great pains to instruct her in scholarship, and she was going to reward the woman by stealing her most valuable possession and leaving a broken replacement. It made Shallan feel sick. She had expected study beneath Yasna to involve meaningless memorization and busy work, accompanied by chastisement for not being smart enough. That was how her tutors had approached her instruction. Yasna was different.
She gave Shallan a topic and the freedom to pursue it as she wished. Yasna offered encouragement and speculation, but nearly all of their conversations turned to topics like the true nature of scholarship, the purpose of studying, the beauty of knowledge, and its application. Yasna Kolin truly loved learning, and she wanted others to as well. Behind the stern gaze, intense eyes, and rarely smiling lips, Yasna Kolin truly believed in what she was doing, whatever that was. Shallan raised one of her books, but covertly eyed the spines of Yasna's latest stack of tomes. More histories about the heraldic epochs, mythologies, commentaries, books by scholars known to be wild speculators. Yasna's current volume was called Shadows Remembered. Shallan memorized the title. She would try to find a copy and look through it. What was Yasna pursuing? What secrets was she hoping to pry from these volumes, most of them centuries-old copies of copies? Though Shallan had discovered some secrets regarding the Soulcaster, the nature of Yasna's quest, the reason the princess had come to Carbranth, remained elusive. Maddeningly, yet tantalizingly so. Yasna liked to speak of the great women of the past, ones who had not just recorded history, but shaped it. Whatever it was she studied, she felt that it was important. World-changing. "You mustn't be drawn in," Shallan told herself, settling back with book and notes. "Your goal is not to change the world. Your goal is to protect your brothers and your house." Still, she needed to make a good show of her wardship, and that gave her a reason to immerse herself for 2 hours, until footsteps in the hallway interrupted, likely the servants bringing the midday meal. Yasna and Shallan often ate on their balcony. Shallan's stomach grumbled as she smelled the food, and she gleefully set aside her book. She usually sketched at lunch, an activity that Yasna, despite her dislike of the visual arts, encouraged. She said that highborn men often thought drawing and painting to be enticing in a woman, and so Shallan should maintain her skills, if only for the purpose of attracting suitors. Shallan didn't know whether to find that insulting or not. And what did it say about Yasna's own intentions for marriage, that she herself never bothered with the more becoming feminine arts, like music or drawing? "Your Majesty," Yasna said, rising smoothly. Shallan started and looked hastily over her shoulder. The elderly king of Carbranth was standing in the doorway, wearing magnificent orange and white robes with detailed embroidery. Shallan scrambled to her feet.
"Brightness, Yasna," the king said. "Am I interrupting?"
"Your company is never an interruption, Your Majesty," Yasna said. She had to be as surprised as Shallan was, yet didn't display a moment of discomfort or anxiety. "We were soon to take lunch, anyway."
"I know, Brightness," Taravangian said. "I hope you don't mind if I join you."
A group of servants began bringing in food and a table. "Not at all," Yasna said. The servants hurried to set things up, putting two different tablecloths on the round table to separate the genders during dining. They secured the half-moons of cloth, red for the king, blue for the women, with weights at the center. Covered plates filled with food followed. A clear, cold stew with sweet vegetables for the women. A spicy-smelling broth for the king. Carbranthians preferred soups for their lunches. Shallan was surprised to see them set a place for her. Her father had never eaten at the same table as his children. Even she, his favorite, had been relegated to her own table. Once Yasna sat, Shallan did likewise. Her stomach growled again, and the king waved for them to begin. His motion seemed ungainly compared with Yasna's elegance. Shallan was soon eating contentedly, with grace, as a woman should, safe hand in her lap, using her free hand and a skewer to spear chunks of vegetable or fruit. The king slurped, but he wasn't as noisy as many men. Why had he deigned to visit? Wouldn't a formal dinner invitation have been more proper? Of course, she learned that Taravangian wasn't known for his mastery of protocol. He was a popular king, beloved by the Dark Eyes as a builder of hospitals. However, the Light Eyes considered him less than bright. He was not an idiot. In light-eyed politics, unfortunately, being only average was a disadvantage. As they ate, the silence drew out, becoming awkward. Several times the king looked as if he wanted to say something, but then turned back to his soup. He seemed intimidated by Jasnah. "And how is your granddaughter, Your Majesty?" Jasnah eventually asked. "She is recovering well?"
"Quite well, thank you,"
Taravangian said, as if relieved to begin conversing.
"Though she now avoids the narrower corridors of the conclave, I do want to thank you for your aid."
"It is always fulfilling to be of service, Your Majesty."
"If you will forgive my saying so, the Ardents do not think much of your service,"
Taravangian said.
"I realize it is likely a sensitive topic. Perhaps I shouldn't mention it, but..."
"No, feel free," Jasnah said, eating a small green lirnip from the end of her skewer.
"I'm not ashamed of my choices." "Then you'll forgive an old man's curiosity?"
"I always forgive curiosity, Your Majesty," Jasnah said. "It strikes me as one of the most genuine of emotions."
"Then where did you find it?"
Taravangian asked, nodding toward the soulcaster, which Jasnah wore covered by a black glove.
"How did you keep it from the devotaries?"
"One might find those questions dangerous, Your Majesty."
"I've already acquired some new enemies by welcoming you."
"You will be forgiven," Jasnah said, "depending on the devotary you have chosen."
"Forgiven? Me?"
The elderly man seemed to find that amusing, and for a moment Shallan thought she saw deep regret in his expression.
"Unlikely. But that is something else entirely. Please, I stand by my questions."
"And I stand by my evasiveness, Your Majesty. I'm sorry. I do forgive your curiosity, but I cannot reward it. These secrets are mine."
"Of course, of course."
The king sat back, looking embarrassed.
"Now you probably assume I brought this meal simply to ambush you about the Fabriel."
"You had another purpose, then?"
"Well, you see, I've heard the most wonderful things about your ward's artistic skill. I thought that maybe..."
He smiled at Shallan. "Of course, Your Majesty," Shallan said. "I'd be happy to draw your likeness." He beamed as she stood, leaving her meal half-eaten and gathering her things. She glanced at Jasnah, but the older woman's face was unreadable. "Would you prefer a simple portrait against a white background?" Shallan asked. "Or would you prefer broader perspective, including surroundings?"
"Perhaps," Jasnah said pointedly. "You should wait until the meal is finished, Shallan."
Shallan blushed, feeling a fool for her enthusiasm. "Of course."
"No, no," the king said. "I'm quite finished. A wider sketch would be perfect, child. How would you like me to sit?"
He slid his chair back, posing and smiling in a grandfatherly way. She blinked, fixing the image in her mind. "That is perfect, Your Majesty. You can return to your meal."
"Don't you need me to sit still? I've posed for portraits before."
"It's all right," Shallan assured him, sitting down.
"Very well," he said, pulling back to the table. "I do apologize for making you use me, of all people, as a subject for your art. This face of mine isn't the most impressive one you've depicted, I'm sure."
"Nonsense," Shallan said. "A face like yours is just what an artist needs."
"It is?"
"Yes, the..." She cut herself off. She'd been about to quip. "Yes, the skin is enough like parchment to make an ideal canvas. That handsome nose of yours and wise furrowed skin, it will be quite striking in the black charcoal."
"Oh, well then, proceed." though I still can't see how you'll work without me holding a pose.
Brightness Shallan has some unique talents, Yasna said. Shallan began her sketch.
I suppose that she must, the king said. I've seen the drawing she did for Varus.
Varus? Yasna asked.
The Palinaeum's assistant chief of collections, the king said. A distant cousin of mine. He says the staff is quite taken with your young ward. How did you find her?
Unexpectedly, Yasna said. And in need of an education. The king cocked his head. The artistic skill I cannot claim, Yasna said. It was a pre-existing condition.
Ah, a blessing of the Almighty.
You might say that.
But you would not, I assume.
Taravangian chuckled awkwardly. Shallan drew quickly, establishing the shape of his head. He shuffled uncomfortably.
Is it hard for you, Yasna? Painful, I mean.
Atheism is not a disease, Your Majesty, Yasna said dryly.
It's not as if I've caught a foot rash. Of course not, of course not. But, isn't it difficult, having nothing in which to believe?
Shallan leaned forward, still sketching, but keeping her attention on the conversation. Shallan had assumed that training under a heretic would be a little more exciting. She and Cabsal, the witty ardent whom she'd met on her first day in Carbranth, had chatted several times now about Yasna's faith. However, around Yasna herself, the topic almost never came up. When it did, Yasna usually changed it. Today, however, she did not. Perhaps she sensed the sincerity in the king's question.
I wouldn't say that I have nothing to believe in, Your Majesty. Actually, I have much to believe in. My brother and my uncle, my own abilities, the things I was taught by my parents. But what is right and wrong, you've discarded that.
Just because I do not accept the teachings of the devotees does not mean I've discarded a belief in right and wrong.
But the Almighty determines what is right.
Must someone, some unseen thing, declare what is right for it to be right? I believe that my own morality, which answers only to my heart, is more sure and true than the morality of those who do right only because they fear retribution.
But that is the soul of law, the king said, sounding confused. If there is no punishment, there can only be chaos.
If there were no law, some men would do as they wish, yes, Yasna said. But isn't it remarkable that, given the chance for personal gain at the cost of others, so many people choose what is right?
Because they fear the Almighty.
No, Yasna said. I think something innate in us understands that seeking the good of society is usually best for the individual as well. Humankind is noble, when we give it the chance to be. That nobility is something that exists independent of any god's decree.
I just don't see how anything could be outside God's decrees.
The king shook his head, bemused.
Brightness, Yasna, I don't mean to argue, but isn't the very definition of the Almighty that all things exist because of him?
If you add one and one, that makes two, does it not?
Well, yes.
No god needs declare it so for it to be true, Yasna said. So could we not say that mathematics exists outside the Almighty, independent of him?
Perhaps.
Well, Yasna said, I simply claim that morality and human will are independent of him, too.
If you say that, the king said, chuckling, then you've removed all purpose for the Almighty's existence.
Indeed. The balcony fell silent. Yasna's sphere lamps cast a cool, even white light across them. For an uncomfortable moment, the only sound was the scratching of Shallan's charcoal on her drawing pad. She worked with quick scraping motions, disturbed by the things that Yasna had said. They made her feel hollow inside. That was partly because the king,
for all his affability, was not good at arguing. He was a dear man, but no match for Jasnah in a conversation.
"Well," Taravangian said, "I must say that you make your points quite effectively. I don't accept them, though."
"My intention is not to convert, Your Majesty," Jasnah said. "I am content keeping my beliefs to myself, something most of my colleagues in the devotaries have difficulty doing. Shallan, have you finished yet?"
"Quite nearly, Brightness."
"But it's been barely a few minutes," the king said.
"She has remarkable skill, Your Majesty," Jasnah said. "As I believe I mentioned." Shallan sat back, inspecting her piece. She'd been so focused on the conversation she'd just let her hands do the drawing, trusting in her instincts. The sketch depicted the king, sitting in his chair with a wise expression, the turret-like balcony walls behind him. The doorway into the balcony was to his right. Yes, it was a good likeness. Not her best work, but... Shallan froze, her breath catching, her heart lurching in her chest. She had drawn something standing in the doorway behind the king. Two tall and willowy creatures with cloaks that split down the front and hung at the sides too stiffly, as if they were made of glass. Above the stiff high collars where the creatures' heads should be, each had a large floating symbol of twisted design, full of impossible angles and geometries. Shallan sat, stunned. Why had she drawn those things? What had driven her to... She snapped her head up. The hallway was empty. The creatures hadn't been part of the memory she'd taken. Her hands had simply drawn them of their own accord. "Shallan," Jasnah said. By reflex, Shallan dropped her charcoal and grabbed the sheet in her free hand, crumpling it.
"I'm sorry, Brightness. I paid too much attention to the conversation. I let myself grow sloppy."
"Well, certainly we can at least see it, child," the king said, standing.
Shallan tightened her grip. "Please, no." "She has an artist's temperament at times, Your Majesty," Jasnah sighed. "There will be no getting it out of her."
"I'll do you another, Your Majesty," Shallan said. "I'm so sorry."
He rubbed his wispy beard.
"Yes, well, it was going to be a gift for my granddaughter."
"By the end of the day," Shallan promised.
"That would be wonderful. You're certain you don't need me to pose?"
No, that won't be necessary, Your Majesty," Shallan said. Her pulse was still racing, and she couldn't shake the image of those two distorted figures from her mind, so she took another memory of the king. She could use that to create a more suitable picture.
"Well then," the king said, "I suppose I should be going. I wish to visit one of the hospitals and the sick. You can send the drawing to my rooms, but take your time. Really, it is quite all right."
Shallan curtsied, crushed paper still held to her breast. The king withdrew with his attendants, several parchmen entering to remove the table.
"I've never known you to make a mistake in drawing," Jasnah said, sitting back down at the desk.
"At least not one so horrible that you destroyed the paper."
Shallan blushed. "Even the master of an art may err, I suppose.
Go ahead and take the next hour to do His Majesty a proper portrait." Shallan looked down at the ruined sketch. The creatures were simply her fancy, the product of letting her mind wander. That was all. Just imagination. Perhaps there was something in her subconscious that she'd needed to express. But what could the figures mean, then?
"I noticed that at one point when you were speaking to the king you hesitated," Jasnah said. "What didn't you say?"
"Something inappropriate."
"But clever?"
"Cleverness never seems quite so impressive when regarded outside the moment, Brightness. It was just a silly thought."
"And you replaced it with an empty compliment?"
"I think you misunderstood what I was trying to explain, child.
I do not wish for you to remain silent. It is good to be clever."
"But if I'd spoken," Shallan said, "I'd have insulted the king. Perhaps confused him as well, which would have caused him embarrassment." I am certain he knows what people say about his slowness of thought.
Yasna sniffed. Idle words. From foolish people. But perhaps it was wise not to speak. Though keep in mind that channeling your capacities and stifling them are two separate things. I'd much prefer you to think of something both clever and appropriate.
Yes, Brightness.
Besides, Yasna said, I believe you might have made Taravangian laugh. He seems haunted by something lately.
You don't find him dull, then?
Shallan asked. She herself didn't think the king dull or a fool, but she'd thought someone as intelligent and learned as Yasna might not have patience for a man like him. Taravangian is a wonderful man, Yasna said, and worth 100 self-proclaimed experts on courtly ways. He reminds me of my uncle Dalinar. Earnest, sincere, concerned.
The light eyes here say he's weak, Shallan said. Because he panders to so many other monarchs, because he fears war, because he doesn't have a shard blade.
Yasna didn't reply, though she looked disturbed.
Brightness?
Shallan prodded, walking to her own seat and arranging her charcoals. In ancient days, Yasna said, a man who brought peace to his kingdom was considered to be of great worth. Now that same man would be derided as a coward. She shook her head. It has been centuries coming, this change. It should terrify us. We could do with more men like Taravangian. And I shall require you to never call him dull again, not even in passing.
Yes, Brightness,
Shallan said, bowing her head.
Did you really believe the things you said? About the Almighty?
Yasna was quiet for a moment. I do, though perhaps I overstated my conviction.
The assuredness movement of rhetorical theory?
Yes, Yasna said. I suppose that it was. I must be careful not to put my back toward you as I read today. Shallan smiled. A true scholar must not close her mind closed on any topic, Yasna said, no matter how certain she may feel. Just because I have not yet found a convincing reason to join one of the devotaries does not mean I never will. Though each time I have a discussion like the one today, my convictions grow firmer. Shallan bit her lip. Yasna noticed the expression. You will need to learn to control that, Shallan. It makes your feelings obvious.
Yes, Brightness.
Well, out with it.
Just that your conversation with the king was not entirely fair.
Oh?
Because of his, well, you know, his limited capacity. He did quite remarkably, but he didn't make the arguments that someone more versed in Vorin theology might have.
And what arguments might such a one have made?
Well, I'm not very well trained in that area myself. But I do think that you ignored or at least minimized one vital part of the discussion.
Which is?
Shallan tapped at her breast. Our hearts, Brightness. I believe because I feel something. A closeness to the Almighty. A peace that comes when I live my faith.
The mind is capable of projecting expected emotional responses.
But didn't you yourself argue that the way we act, the way we feel about right and wrong, was a defining attribute of our humanity? You used our innate morality to prove your point. So how can you discard my feelings?
Discard them? No. Regard them with skepticism? Perhaps. Your feelings, Shallan, however powerful, are your own, not mine. And what I feel is that spending my life trying to earn the favor of an unseen, unknown, and unknowable being who watches me from the sky is an exercise in sheer futility. She pointed at Shallan with her pen. But your rhetorical method is improving. We'll make a scholar of you yet. Shallan smiled, feeling a surge of pleasure. Praise from Yasna was more precious than an emerald brome.
But I'm not going to be a scholar.
I'm going to steal the soulcaster and leave.
She didn't like to think about that. That was something else she'd have to get over. She tended to avoid thinking about things that made her uncomfortable.
Now hurry and be about the king's sketch, Jasna said, lifting a book.
You still have a great deal of real work to do once you are done drawing.
Yes, Brightness, Shallan said.
For once, however, she found sketching difficult, her mind too troubled to focus.
Thirty. Darkness Unseen. They were suddenly dangerous, like a calm day that became a tempest. This fragment is the origin of a Thalen proverb that was eventually reworked into a more common derivation. I believe it may reference the Voidbringers. See Ixix's Emperor, 4th chapter. Kaladin walked from the cavernous barrack into the pure light of first morning. Bits of quartz in the ground sparkled before him, catching the light as if the ground were sparking and burning, ready to burst from within. A group of 29 men followed him. Slaves, thieves, deserters, foreigners. Even a few men whose only sin had been poverty. Those had joined the bridge crews out of desperation. The pay was good when compared with nothing, and they were promised that if they survived 100 bridge runs, they would be promoted. Assignment to a watch post, which in the mind of a poor man sounded like a life of luxury. Being paid to stand and look at things all day? What kind of insanity was that? It was like being rich, almost. They didn't understand. Nobody survived 100 bridge runs. Kaladin had been on 24, and he was already one of the most experienced living bridgemen. Bridge 4 followed him. The last of the holdouts, a thin man named Bissig, had given in yesterday. Kaladin preferred to think that the laughter, the food, and the humanity had finally gotten to him. But it had probably been a few glares or under-the-breath threats from Rock and Teft. Kaladin turned a blind eye to those. He'd eventually need the men's loyalty, but for now he'd settle for obedience. He guided them through the morning exercises he'd learned his very first day in the military. Stretches followed by jumping motions. Carpenters in brown work overalls and tan or green caps passed on their way to the lumberyard, shaking their heads in amusement. Soldiers on the short ridge above, where the camp proper began, looked down and laughed. Gaz watched from beside a nearby barrack, arms folded, single eye dissatisfied. Kaladin wiped his brow. He met Gaz's eye for a long moment, then turned back to the men. There was still time to practice hauling the bridge before breakfast. Gaz had never gotten used to having just one eye. Could a man get used to that? He'd rather have lost a hand or a leg than that eye. He couldn't stop feeling that something hid in that darkness he couldn't see, but others could. What lurked there? Spren that would drain his soul from his body, the way a rat could empty an entire wineskin by chewing the corner? His companions called him lucky. That blow could have taken your life. Well, at least then he wouldn't have had to live with that darkness. One of his eyes was always closed. Close the other and the darkness swallowed him. Gaz glanced left, and the darkness scuttled to the side. Lamoral stood leaning against a post, tall and slim. He was not a massive man, but he was not weak. He was all lines. Rectangular beard, rectangular body, sharp, like a knife. Lamoral waved Gaz over, so he reluctantly approached. Then he took a sphere out of his pouch and passed it over, a topaz mark. He hated losing it. He always hated losing money. "You owe me twice as much as this," Lamoral noted, raising the sphere up to look through it as it sparkled in the sunlight. "Well, that's all you'll get for now. Be glad you get anything." "Be glad I've kept my mouth shut," Lamoral said lazily, leaning back against his post. It was one that marked the edge of the lumberyard. Gaz gritted his teeth. He hated to pay, but what else could he do? Storms take him. Raging storms take him. You have a problem, it seems, Lamoral said. At first, Gaz thought he meant the half-payment. The light-eyed man nodded toward Bridge 4's barracks. Gaz eyed the bridgeman, unsettled. The youthful bridge leader barked an order and the bridgeman raced the span of the lumberyard in a jog. He already had them running in time with one another. That one change meant so much. It sped them up, helped them think like a team. Could this boy actually have military training, as he'd once claimed? Why would he be wasted as a bridgeman? Of course, there was that Shash brand on his forehead. I don't see a problem, Gaz said with a grunt. They're fast. That's good. They're insubordinate. They follow orders. His orders, perhaps, Lamoral shook his head. Bridgemen exist for one purpose, Gaz, to protect lives of more valuable men. Really? And here I thought their purpose was to carry bridges. Lamoral gave him a sharp look. He leaned forward. Don't try me, Gaz. And don't forget your place. Would you like to join them? Gaz felt a spike of fear. Lamoral was a very lowly light eyes, one of the landless. But he was Gaz's immediate superior, a liaison between bridge crews and the higher-ranked light eyes who oversaw the lumberyard. Gaz looked down at the ground. I'm sorry, Bright Lord. My Prince Satius holds an edge, Lamoral said, leaning back against his post. He maintains it by pushing us all. Hard. Each man in his place. He nodded toward the members of Bridge 4. Speed is not a bad thing. Initiative is not a bad thing. But men with initiative like that boy's are not often happy in their position. The bridge crews function as they are without need for modification. Change could be unsettling. Gaz doubted that any of the bridgemen really understood their place in Sadius's plans. If they knew why they were worked as pitilessly as they were, and why they were forbidden shields or armor, they likely would just cast themselves into the chasm. Bait. They were bait. Draw the Parshendi attention, let the savages think they were doing some good by felling a few bridges worth of bridgemen every assault. So long as you took plenty of men, that didn't matter. Except to those who were slaughtered. Stormfather, Gaz thought. I hate myself for being a part of this. But he'd hated himself for a long time now. It wasn't anything new to him. I'll do something, he promised Lamoral. A knife in the night, poison in the food. That twisted his insides. The boy's bribes were small, but they were all that let him keep ahead of his payments to Lamoral. No, Lamoral hissed. You want it seen that he was really a threat? The real soldiers are already talking about him. Lamoral grimaced. The last thing we need is a martyr inspiring rebellion among the bridgemen. I don't want any hint of it. Nothing our High Prince's enemies could take advantage of. Lamoral glanced at Kaladin, jogging past again with his men. That one has to fall on the field, as he deserves. Make certain it happens. And get me the rest of the money you owe, or you'll soon find yourself carrying one of those bridges yourself. He swept away, forest green cloak fluttering. In his time as a soldier, Gaz had learned to fear the minor light eyes the most. They were galled by their closeness in rank to the dark eyes, yet those dark eyes were the only ones they had any authority over. That made them dangerous. Being around like Lamoral was like handling a hot coal with bare fingers. There was no way to avoid burning yourself. You just hoped to be quick enough to keep the burns to a minimum. Bridge 4 ran by. A month ago, Gaz wouldn't have believed this possible. A group of bridgemen? Practicing? And all it seemed to have cost Kaladin was a few bribes of food and some empty promises that he would protect them. That shouldn't have been enough. Life as a bridgeman was hopeless. Gaz couldn't join them. He just couldn't. Kaladin the Lordling had to fall. But if Kaladin's spheres vanished, Gaz could just as easily end up as a bridgeman for failing to pay Lamoral. Storming damnation, he thought. It was like trying to choose which claw of the chasm fiend would crush you. Gaz continued to watch Kaladin's crew. And still that darkness waited for him. Like an itch that couldn't be scratched. Like a scream that couldn't be silenced. A tingling numbness that he could never be rid of. It would probably follow him even into death. "Bridge up!" Kaladin bellowed, running with Bridge Four. They raised the bridge over their heads while still moving. It was harder to run this way, holding the bridge up, rather than resting it on the shoulders. He felt its enormous weight on his arms. "Down!" he ordered. Those at the front let go of the bridge and ran out to the sides. The others lowered the bridge in a quick motion. It hit the ground awkwardly, scraping the stone. They got into position, pretending to move it across a chasm. Kaladin helped at the side. "We'll need to practice on a real chasm," he thought as the men finished. "I wonder what kind of bribe it would take for Gaz to let me do that." The bridgemen, finished with their mock bridge run, looked toward Kaladin, exhausted but excited. He smiled at them. As a squad leader those months in Amaram's army, he'd learned that praise should be honest, but it should never be withheld. "We need to work on that set down," Kaladin said. "But overall, I'm impressed. 2 weeks and you're already working together as well as some teams I trained for months. I'm pleased. And proud. Go get something to drink and take a break. We'll do one or two more runs before work detail." It was stone-gathering duty again, but that was nothing to complain about. He'd convinced the men that lifting the stones would improve their strength, and had enlisted the few he trusted the most to help gather the knobweed, the means by which he continued to, just barely, keep the men supplied with extra food and build his stock of medical supplies. 2 weeks. An easy 2 weeks, as the lives of bridgemen went. Only two bridge runs, and on one they'd gotten to the plateau too late. The Parshendi had escaped with the gem heart before they'd even arrived. That was good for bridgemen. The other assault hadn't been too bad by bridgemen numbers. Two more dead, Amark and Kulf. Two more wounded, Narm and Pete. A fraction of what the other crews had lost, but still too many. Kaladin tried to keep his expression optimistic as he walked to the water barrel and took a ladle from one of the men, drinking it down. Bridge Four would drown in its own wounded. They were only 30 strong, with 5 wounded who drew no pay and had to be fed out of the knobweed income. Counting those who'd died, they'd taken nearly 30% casualties in the weeks he'd begun trying to protect them. In Amaram's army, that rate of casualties would have been catastrophic. Back then, Kaladin's life had been one of training and marching, punctuated by occasional frenzied bursts of battle. Here, the fighting was relentless. Every few days. That kind of thing could, would, wear an army down. There has to be a better way, Kaladin thought, swishing the lukewarm water in his mouth, then pouring another ladle on his head. He couldn't continue to lose 2 men a week to death and wounds. But how could they survive when their own officers didn't care if they lived or died? He barely kept himself from throwing the ladle into the barrel in frustration. Instead, he handed it to Scar and gave him an encouraging smile. A lie, but an important one. Gaz watched from the shadow of one of the other bridgemen barracks. Syl's translucent figure, shaped now like floating knobweed fluff, flitted around the bridge sergeant. Eventually, she made her way over to Kaladin, landing on his shoulder, taking her female form. "He's planning something," she said. "He hasn't interfered," Kaladin said. "He hasn't even tried to stop us from having the nightly stew."
"He was talking to that Light Eyes."
"Lamoral?" She nodded. "Lamoral's his superior," Kaladin said as he walked into the shade of Bridge Four's barrack. He leaned against the wall, looking over at his men by the water barrel. They talked to one another now, joked, laughed. They went out drinking together in the evenings. Stormfather, but he never thought he'd be glad that the men under his command went drinking.
I didn't like their expressions, Syl said, sitting down on Kaladin's shoulder. Dark, like thunderclouds. I didn't hear what they were saying. I noticed them too late. But I don't like it, particularly that Lamoral. Kaladin nodded slowly. You don't trust him either? Syl asked.
He's a light eyes. That was enough.
So we
do nothing, Kaladin said. I can't respond unless they try something. And if I spend all of my energy worrying about what they might do, I won't be able to solve the problems we're facing right now. What he didn't add was his real worry. If Gaz or Lamoral decided to have Kaladin killed, there was little he could do to stop them. True, bridgemen were rarely executed for anything other than failing to run their bridge, but even in an honest force like Amaram's, there had been rumors of trumped-up charges and fake evidence. In Sadius's undisciplined, barely regulated camp, nobody would blink if Kaladin, a Shash-brand slave, was strung up on some nebulous charge. They could leave him for the High Storm, washing their hands of his death, claiming that the Stormfather had chosen his fate. Kaladin stood up straight and walked toward the carpentry section of the lumberyard. The craftsmen and their apprentices were hard at work, cutting lengths of wood for spear hafts, bridges, posts, or furniture. The craftsmen nodded to Kaladin as he passed. They were familiar with him now, used to his odd requests, like pieces of lumber long enough for four men to hold and run with to practice keeping cadence with one another. He found a half-finished bridge. It had eventually grown out of that one plank that Kaladin had used. Kaladin knelt down, inspecting the wood. A group of men worked with a large saw just to his right, slicing thin rounds off a log. Those would probably become chair seats. He ran his fingers along the smooth hardwood. All mobile bridges were made of a kind of wood called macum. It had a deep brown color, the grain almost hidden, and was both strong and light. The craftsmen had sanded this length smooth, and it smelled of sawdust and musky sap.
Kaladin? Syl asked, walking through the air, then stepping onto the wood. You look distant.
It's ironic how well they craft these bridges, he said. This army's carpenters are far more professional than its soldiers.
That makes sense, she said. The craftsmen want to make bridges that last. The soldiers I listen to, they just want to get to the plateau, grab the gem heart, and get away. It's like a game to them.
That's astute. You're getting better and better at observing us. She grimaced.
I feel like I'm remembering things I once knew.
Soon you'll hardly be a spren at all. You'll be a little translucent philosopher. We'll have to send you off to a monastery to spend your time in deep, important thoughts.
Yes, she said. Like how to best get the Ardents there to accidentally drink a mixture that will turn his mouth blue.
She smiled mischievously. Kaladin smiled back, but kept running his finger across the wood. He still didn't understand why they wouldn't let bridgemen carry shields. Nobody would give him a straight answer on the question. They use macum because it's strong enough for its weight to support a heavy cavalry charge, he said. We should be able to use this. They deny us shields, but we already carry one on our shoulders.
But how would they react if you try that?
Kaladin stood. I don't know, but I also don't have any other choice. Trying this would be a risk, a huge risk. But he'd run out of non-risky ideas days ago. We can hold it here, Kaladin said, pointing for Rock, Teft, Scar, and Moash. They stood beside a bridge turned up on its side, its underbelly exposed. The bottom was a complicated construction, with eight rows of three positions accommodating up to 24 men directly underneath, then 16 sets of handles, eight on each side, for 16 more men on the outside. 40 men, running shoulder to shoulder, if they had a full complement. Each position underneath the bridge had an indentation for the bridgeman's head, two curved blocks of wood to rest on his shoulders, and two rods for handholds. The bridgemen wore shoulder pads, and those who were shorter wore extras to compensate. Gaz generally tried to assign new bridgemen to crews based on their height. That didn't hold for Bridge 4, of course. Bridge 4 just got the leftovers. Kaladin pointed to several rods and struts. We could grab here, then run straight forward, carrying the bridge on its side to our right at a slant. We put our taller men on the outside, and our shorter men on the inside.
What good would that do? Rock asked, frowning.
Kaladin glanced at Gaz, who was watching from nearby, uncomfortably close. Best not to speak of why he really wanted to carry the bridge on its side. Besides, he didn't want to get the men's hopes up until he knew if it would work. I just want to experiment, he said. If we can shift positions occasionally, it might be easier. Work different muscles. Syl frowned as she stood on top of the bridge. She always frowned when Kaladin obscured the truth. Gather the men, Kaladin said, waving to Rock, Teft, Scar, and Moash. He'd named the four as his sub-squad commanders, something that bridgemen didn't normally have. But soldiers worked best in smaller groups of six or eight. Soldiers, Kaladin thought. Is that how I think of them? They didn't fight, but yes, they were soldiers. It was too easy to underestimate men when you considered them to be just bridgemen. Charging straight at enemy archers without shields took courage, even when you were compelled to do it. He glanced to the side, noticing that Moash hadn't left with the other three. The narrow-faced man had dark green eyes and brown hair flecked with black. Something wrong, soldier? Kaladin asked. Moash blinked in surprise at the use of the word, but he and the others had grown to expect all kinds of unorthodoxy from Kaladin. Why did you make me squad leader of a sub-squad? Because you resisted my leadership longer than almost any of the others? And you were flat-out more vocal about it than any of them. You made me a squad leader because I refused to obey you? I made you squad leader because you struck me as capable and intelligent. But beyond that, you weren't swayed too easily. You're strong-willed. I can use that. Moash scratched his chin with its short beard. All right, then. But unlike Teft and that horn-eater, I don't think you're a gift straight from the Almighty. I don't trust you. Then why obey me? Moash met his eyes, then shrugged. Guess I'm curious. He moved off to gather his squad.
What in the raging winds? Gaz thought, dumbfounded as he watched Bridge 4 charge past. What had possessed them to try carrying the bridge to the side?
It required them to clump up in an odd way, forming three rows instead of five, awkwardly clutching the underside of the bridge and holding it off to their right. It was one of the strangest things he'd ever seen. They could barely all fit, and the handholds weren't made for carrying the bridge that way. Gaz scratched his head as he watched them pass, then held out a hand, stopping Kaladin as he jogged by. The lordling let go of the bridge and hurried up to Gaz, wiping his brow as the others continued running.
Yes?
What is that?
Gaz said, pointing.
Bridge crew. Carrying what I believe is...
Yes, it's a bridge.
I didn't ask for lip, Gaz snarled. I want an explanation.
Carrying the bridge over our heads gets tiring, Kaladin said. He was a tall man, tall enough to tower over Gaz.
Storm it, I will not be intimidated.
This is a way to use different muscles, like shifting a pack from one shoulder to the other. Gaz glanced to the side. Had something moved in the darkness?
Gaz? Kaladin asked.
Look, lordling, Gaz said, looking back to him. Carrying it overhead may be tiring, but carrying it like that is just plain stupid. You look like you're about to stumble over one another. And the handholds are terrible. You can barely fit the men.
Yes, Kaladin said more softly. But a lot of the time only half of a bridge crew will survive a bridge run. We can carry it back this way when there are fewer of us. It will let us shift positions at least.
Gaz hesitated.
Only half a bridge crew. If they carried the bridge like that on an actual assault, they'd go slowly, expose themselves. It could be a disaster, for Bridge 4 at least. Gas smiled.
I like it.
Kaladin looked shocked.
What?
Initiative. Creativity.
Yes. Keep practicing. I'd very much like to see you make a plateau approach carrying the bridge that way.
Kaladin narrowed his eyes.
Is that so?
Yes, Gaz said.
Well then, perhaps we will.
Gaz smiled, watching Kaladin retreat. A disaster was exactly what he needed. Now he just had to find some other way to pay Lamoral's blackmail.
Beneath the Skin. 6 years and 7 months ago.
Don't make the same mistake I did, son.
Cal looked up from his folio. His father sat on the other side of the operating room, one hand to his head, half-empty cup of wine in his other. Violet wine, among the strongest of liquors. Liren set the cup down, and the deep purple liquid, the color of Kremling blood, shivered and trembled. It refracted stormlight from a couple of spheres sitting on the counter.
Father? When you get to Carbranth, stay there.
His voice was slurred.
Don't get sucked back to this tiny, backward, foolish town. Don't force your beautiful wife to live away from everyone else she's ever known or loved.
Cal's father didn't often get drunk. This was a rare night of indulgence, perhaps because Mother had gone to sleep early, exhausted from her work.
You've always said I should come back,
Cal said softly.
I'm an idiot.
His back to Cal, he stared at the wall splashed with white light from the spheres.
They don't want me here. They never wanted me here.
Cal looked down at his folio. It contained drawings of dissected bodies, the muscles splayed and pulled out. The drawings were so detailed. Each had glyph pairs to designate every part, and he'd committed those to memory. Now he studied the procedures, delving into the bodies of men long dead. Once, Laurel had told him that men weren't supposed to see beneath the skin. These folios, with their pictures, were part of what made everyone so mistrustful of Liren. Seeing beneath was like seeing beneath the clothing, only worse. Liren poured himself more wine. How much the world could change in a short time. Cal pulled his coat close against the chill. A season of winter had come, but they couldn't afford charcoal for the brazier, for patients no longer gave offerings. Liren hadn't stopped healing or surgery. The townspeople had simply stopped their donations, all at a word from Roshon.
He shouldn't be able to do this, Cal whispered.
But he can, Liren said.
He wore a white shirt and black vest atop tan trousers. The vest was unbuttoned, the front flaps hanging down by his sides, like the skin pulled back from the torsos of the men in Cal's drawings.
We could spend the spheres, Cal said hesitantly.
Those are for your education, Liren snapped. If I could send you now, I would.
Cal's father and mother had sent a letter to the surgeons in Carbranth, asking them to let Cal take the entry tests early. They'd responded in the negative.
He wants us to spend them, Liren said, words slurred. That's why he said what he did. He's trying to bully us into needing those spheres.
Roshon's words to the townspeople hadn't actually been a command. He'd just implied that if Cal's father was too foolish to charge, then he shouldn't be paid. The next day, people had stopped donating. The townsfolk regarded Roshon with a confusing mixture of adoration and fear. In Cal's opinion, he didn't deserve either. Obviously, the man had been banished to Hearthstone because he was so bitter and flawed. He clearly didn't deserve to be among the real Light Eyes,
who fought for vengeance on the shattered plains.
Why do the people try so hard to please him? Cal asked of his father's back. They never reacted this way around Bright Lord Wistio.
They do it because Roshon is unappeasable.
Cal frowned. Was that the wine talking?
Cal's father turned, his eyes reflecting pure stormlight. In those eyes, Cal saw a surprising lucidity. He wasn't so drunk after all. Bright Lord Wistio let men do as they wished, and so they ignored him. Roshon lets them know he finds them contemptible, and so they scramble to please him.
That makes no sense, Cal said.
It is the way of things, Liren said, playing with one of the spheres on the table, rolling it beneath his finger. You'll have to learn this, Cal. When men perceive the world as being right, we are content. But if we see a hole, a deficiency, we scramble to fill it.
You make it sound noble, what they do.
It is, in a way, Liren said. He sighed. I shouldn't be so hard on our neighbors. They're petty, yes, but it's the pettiness of the ignorant. I'm not disgusted by them. I'm disgusted by the one who manipulates them. A man like Roshon can take what is honest and true in men and twist it into a mess of sludge to walk on.
He took a sip, finishing the wine.
We should just spend the spheres, Cal said, or send them somewhere, to a moneylender or something. If they were gone, he'd leave us alone.
No, Liren said softly. Roshon is not the kind to spare a man once he is beaten. He's the type who keeps kicking. I don't know what political mistake landed him in this place, but he obviously can't get revenge on his rivals. So we're all he has.
Liren paused. Poor fool.